From Tennessee to New York, Nevada to Wisconsin, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, equity markets were rattled this past week by concerns over the coronavirus. Despite that, the U.S. economy remains strong. We talk with Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. The federal response to the coronavirus was the main topic of discussion on Capitol Hill in recent days as Congress prepares to spend billions to contain the outbreak. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The healthcare industry uses government regulation to stifle potential competition. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Matt Mitchell of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And Bernie Sanders embraces the socialist label, but Pete Buttigieg is steeped in socialist ideology as well. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A major sell-off in the equity markets took place this past week as investors reacted to the economic impact of the coronavirus outbreak. But overall, the U.S. economy remains strong. Here to talk about it is Phil Kirpin. He is president of American Commitment. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, of course, we have seen a major pullback in the equity markets this past week, owing, of course, to the coronavirus. Setting that aside, though, as you look at the American economy, do you still see the fundamentals of the economy as being sound?
Yeah, I think the fundamentals of this economy are very, very strong. We've got really strong labor market numbers. We've got very low, record low unemployment figures. We've got reasonably strong wage growth. And the reason stocks had been very strong and still had a very positive outlook until this sell-off was that corporate earnings have been strong and have continued to be strong. And you know, this round of corporate earnings that we just saw, I think they were up another 5 or 6% when there had been some hesitation that they might be flat or even declining. And so we've got an economy right now that's very strong. And the public opinion data reflects an awful lot of personal financial satisfaction. And so Gallup just did a whole bunch of questions on this. And they've got long time series because they've been asking the same questions for a long, long time. And on things like, are you better off financially than you were a year ago? Are you better off than you were 3 years ago? Do you expect to be even better off a year from now? Those numbers are all up in the 60s and they're at 20-year highs, record highs in some cases, that kind of thing. And so we've got very positive economic sentiment still in terms of how people feel about their own finances and sort of what we see in the economy more broadly. That said, Loman, this might be more than a hiccup. We don't know how bad this health situation is, and the virus, it could spread to the U.S., and we could be dealing with sort of the immediate risks associated with that here. But even if it stays largely contained in China, there's this question of how much that affects the supply chains of U.S. manufacturers and other major international companies who count on suppliers in China. And so there's an awful lot of uncertainty right now. And from a political economy standpoint, that means that what was sort of the strongest point that the president and Republicans have is a little bit in doubt, just because nobody knows exactly how this is going to play out. Of course, you can't prevent something like this. It's not really a policy issue. That said, the Democrats seem to be sort of betting on this, and the chance that this does get worse, they kind of see as their opportunity, and so they're sort of preemptively attacking the president and his handling of this. The flip side of that coin, of course, is if it is relatively contained, if it's sort of seasonal, if the threat recedes, you know, the president will be able to claim a great victory, and it'll be another success and that kind of thing. So I think that there are high political and economic stakes with this, but there's just a massive amount of uncertainty. We just don't know how it's going to play out.
Despite the fact, Phil, that Democrats, of course, are going to pounce on this and in a rather perverse way, sort of hoping that this does the economy in because it rebounds to their political benefit. But setting that aside, especially referencing the employment and unemployment numbers that you talked about, this has been an amazingly strong economy, has it not, where these economic numbers, the employment numbers, have really benefited all segments of the economy. I know that the Democrats like to say, well, Trump's benefiting the 1%, but really it's minorities who are benefiting, correct?
Well, the strongest wage growth we've seen for the last couple of years has been in the lowest wage occupations. And so we're seeing a real competition for employees, for workers, especially at the lower end. And that means that people have bargaining power for the first time in a long time. I mean, I remember a story last year in the Wall Street Journal about how a lot of companies are having problems with what they called ghosting employees, people who just stop showing up for work because they got another job somewhere else and they don't even bother to tell the previous employer. They just stop showing up. That's not a good thing to do. I don't recommend it. If you're going to quit a job, you should tell someone you're going to quit. It's a simple courtesy thing. But those stories wouldn't exist at all if there weren't an awful lot of competition and demand for workers, particularly on the lower end. And we're certainly seeing that in the wage growth data. And we've seen, you know, annual wage growth is around 3%. But in the lower wage industries, it's much higher than that. Lower wage segment, it's been 5 or 6 or 7%. And so we're seeing people who maybe a few years ago had no jobs available, now have multiple jobs available and the ability to actually bargain for higher pay or move between jobs to get higher pay. And so that's a big positive economically, but it's also, of course, a big positive politically because, you know, somebody who was in very tough economic situation a couple of years ago, who now sort of is in the, you know, in the position of being able to command a higher wage and, you know, being in demand, is unlikely to want to vote for Democrats who are going to disrupt that, go back to the policies that we had under Obama and what have you.
The president, of course, helped to, in large measure, spur this economy with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of a couple of years ago, Phil. There's been some talk from the White House of another middle-class tax cut, obviously a good plank to run on in an election year. Given the nature of Congress, however, is there any realistic hope that another tax cut could be forthcoming this year?
No, Nancy Pelosi is not cutting anyone's taxes. Nancy Pelosi only likes to raise taxes. Now, that's not going to happen either with Republican Senate and President Trump. So any tax plans we see this year, and I do think you're going to see a legislative proposal from the White House with another round of tax cuts, but it'll really be more for positioning in the election with the hopes of, you know, having a Republican House next year and being able to then have tax cuts 2.0. So I do think we will see a plan, and I hope it'll be another good one, another strong one that sort of builds on what they did in the last round. But I wouldn't have any expectation of it passing before the election.
You did say earlier there's a lot of uncertainty in the economy right now, largely owing to the coronavirus. Another element of uncertainty is the outcome of the presidential election. Given that Bernie Sanders appears to be the front runner at the moment, do you see that as being a political factor that may begin weighing on the markets, particularly if Senator Sanders continues to hold a commanding position?
I do. You think that the danger of a Sanders presidency is enormous for any number of industries that he would outright nationalize or, you know, massively regulate, impose government controls over. In particular, I mean, he's openly campaigning on basically nationalization of the entire healthcare sector of the economy. He says things like pharmaceutical companies shouldn't be allowed to make profits. Well, profit making is sort of the way we allocate resources in a free market economy, in a capitalist economy. When you talk about prohibiting profits, you're talking about a command economy. You're talking about really not having private businesses engaged in that activity anymore. And that obviously is going to be pretty devastating for the businesses that are at risk of nationalization. And, you know, he would do it. He would basically take over the entire healthcare sector. He's talked about having government step in and be the producer in electricity markets and directly build renewable energy resources and sell them into the grid. And so he's talking about a much, much heavier handed government role in the economy, much more moving in the direction of government-owned enterprise command economy.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin, who is president of American Commitment. And Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment.
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all of the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues. We try to identify the issues that are on the margin, could go either way, where a little bit of citizen education and involvement could make a difference in a more free market direction. And all of our information and activism opportunities are on our website at AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being with us.
All right.
Scott Parkinson is at the nation's capital where the coronavirus is now the talk of the town. And Scott, first of all, thank you for being here again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Loman. Good to be back.
This, of course, a very dire situation. It has rattled the markets, the equity markets, big time this past week. So a lot of Americans are going to be looking, Scott, to Washington to see what the response of our government is going to be. Tell us what has been occurring over the last few days, specifically regards funding.
The Office of Management and Budget has requested supplemental funding from Congress to deal with the coronavirus response effort. A few key takeaways from that request include $1.25 billion in emergency funding for HHS, and they're also asking Congress to authorize moving $535 million of unused Ebola funding. They're also asking for enhanced transfer authority within HHS, meaning HHS would be able to move money around quickly wherever there's a necessity. But in sum, the requests to the response efforts on coronavirus would allocate at least $2.5 billion for additional federal funding. I think what we're seeing now on Capitol Hill is Secretary Azar from HHS met with congressional appropriators, and some of the appropriators felt like HHS wasn't requesting enough money. I think that gets back to the addiction that we've talked about here on the show, the addiction to federal spending. They don't really mind spending the American people's money. But in this instance, there is certainly a responsibility for our government to prevent epidemics within the United States and protect the American people.
Certainly, Scott, it is prudent to be prepared. And as we look at what happened in China, where obviously the government was not prepared, did not handle it well, is this going to be another case, though, of where the big spenders in Congress let no disaster, no emergency go to waste, and we're going to start seeing extraneous dollars added in to what should be only extra funding for dealing with this particular virus?
Yeah, and I've actually been talking directly with members of Congress this week about that specific question. I think what's clear is that the president and his administration have come in with a focused plan. We don't want to see this effort politicized by members of Congress. We want to see the appropriation requests approved. And then if people have extraneous measures that they're interested in passing, there will always be the next crisis in Washington to try to deal with that. But this is a real serious effort and a necessity to make sure that we stop the coronavirus from expanding to the American population.
In terms of extraneous items being brought into the discussion and the need to actually get Congress all on the same page and quickly, are we seeing a coalition forming that Congress is going to act and provide these dollars in an expeditious fashion?
I would expect that the supplemental appropriation will be approved by Congress pretty quickly here. There are various process and rules in the congressional rules package that allow you to expedite the passage of important legislation. Certainly in the Senate, you need unanimous consent to do that, but you can still get things done within a week pretty quickly, which is fast in Washington, right? This isn't going to be a month from now. I think this is going to be in the near term. And then as we do look sort of what's coming next, obviously we're going to closely be watching what happens in other Asian markets. We're going to be watching what happens in these countries as more data is provided to the American public and also to the global public. Whether there have been 80,000 worldwide cases or 8 million, we don't know, because China and their government have always tried to maintain order by having censorship of information and not allowing for free flow of information to reach its people. Imagine if there was a chaotic situation, which I imagine we're getting pretty closely to in China with all these lockdowns. The consequence of unrest in China would be catastrophic for their government. And obviously, when you're a communist nation, all you care about is control of the people. You don't care about life. So they will do everything that they can to control their population and make sure that there's not a large mass unrest. And so you've also got the head of the Olympic Committee warning folks that there may be a cancellation of the Summer Olympics. They're going to make that decision here in a couple of months. But right now, I think it's fair to say, without any vaccination and without a clear plan of containment on the global scale, the Summer Olympics are certainly at risk of being canceled.
Looking at this then, Scott, the fact that the Chinese government is, first of all, withholds information, and when they do put information out, it holds no credibility because you don't know what is spin and what is true. Is that exacerbating the situation we have with the equity markets this past week? Is that one of the contributing factors to the fact that they've been so rattled?
Yeah, I think it is. The main exposure here is the fact that so many key global multinational corporations are very reliant on China and its neighbors to help in the production of key items that we consume. And so when you're talking about anything from Caterpillar all the way down to McDonald's, these are major corporations that employ thousands of people, that have thousands of shareholders. And I think that's why you're seeing the markets this week really react in such a volatile fashion. I was watching CNBC earlier, and they did a ticker of all the U.S. corporations that had exposure to China. And as you can imagine, the list was just incredibly long. So the best case scenario here is that we certainly develop a vaccine in the near term here. I think that it's been warned that we might even be a year and a half away from developing any sort of a vaccine. Now, I hate to throw out any timeline there that can really create even more economic panic, but we also have to be clear with the American people on what the federal response is going to be, how they're going to protect, and how they're going to innovate to solve this what's mounting to be a global crisis.
It has had an economic impact. Is there still a political impact, perhaps some fallout for the Trump administration? Because the economy has been a big selling point for Donald Trump, who, while obviously he can't control the coronavirus, could this ultimately impact his standing relative to his reelection?
Absolutely. I think that it could certainly be the October surprise. Look, it's going to be a smell test issue here. If we reach October and early November, you've got early voting going on and then people showing up to the polls. If people feel like there was an inadequate response to this real problem, then I think you're going to see huge political blowback from the president, regardless of how strong the economy is doing.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, give us a little information on the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Most folks have never heard of a certificate of need, but that and other regulations stifle competition in the healthcare industry and drive up costs. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Matt Mitchell from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
Americans are paying more for healthcare than ever before, and at least part of the reason has to do with these little-known state-level regulations called Certificate of Need laws, and that's what we are going to take a look at today. Thanks for joining us, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. You are listening to American Radio Journal. My guest today is Matthew Mitchell. He is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, and he's the co-author of a new report, Phasing Out Certificate of Need Laws, that looks at exactly how we can, you know, phase out certificate of need laws. Matthew, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is something that I've written about, Matthew, obviously something that you do quite a bit of work on over there at Mercatus, but I think most people are probably not all that familiar with certificate of need laws. So let's just start off by, give us a basic idea, if you can, of what these laws are and what they do.
Yeah, so it's basically a permission slip to compete. So if you are a healthcare provider in one of 35 states or the District of Columbia, and you want to open or expand your healthcare facility, you want to add a new hospital bed, buy an MRI machine for drug rehabilitation services, or create a neonatal intensive care unit, you have to go before a regulator and request permission to do so. And in seeking this, they will not be seeking this permission. They're not going to be evaluating your quality or your safety or customer reviews or anything like that. All of that is done through other types of regulation. Instead, the only thing that they're going to be assessing is whether or not they believe that the community needs the service that you're hoping to provide, which is pretty weird, right? You know, in most markets, need is assessed by the expected profitability of whatever product or service you want to offer. And remarkably, in the process of determining whether or not the community needs this product or service, they will be interviewing your the current providers of that product or service, your would-be competitors. The would-be competitors are invited often to come and submit challenges to applications and state why they, all things considered, they would prefer not to have any competition.
Yeah, no surprise that your competitors would say, well, I think we probably have enough drug rehabilitation clinics or neonatal intensive care units here. We don't need any more. And that's just keep competition out of the market. That's good for us. Look, the argument for these laws is that they keep healthcare costs down theoretically, that the, specifically what they would do is eliminate unnecessary capital costs. So do they at least do that, even if we have to sacrifice the market to get it?
No. In short, they don't. So this theory does, of course, go against a couple of centuries of standard economic theory, which suggests that a supply restriction will shift the supply curve leftward, reduce the quantity of products or services offered, and it will raise prices. And what we find is that these laws behave exactly as Economics 101 suggests that they would. The overwhelming amount of evidence is that they do reduce access to care, but there's also quite a bit of evidence that they raise costs. This could be measured a couple of ways. One is you can look at the amount spent on procedures, so what's the cost of a coronary bypass or a well-child checkup or something like that. And the studies, there is zero evidence that they reduce costs, just as theory would predict. In fact, 75% of studies that look on that margin find that they raise costs. And the other way to look at it is to look at total expenditures. How much do you spend per patient? Most studies on this score also find that they seem to raise overall costs. And another reason why we would predict this, of course, is that hospital providers like these things. So if they somehow miraculously reduce spending and reduce prices, it would be really surprising that they would continue to lobby for them. So that's pretty good empirical evidence.
We are talking with Matthew Mitchell. He's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Matt, I want to get into this report that you have published this week. Folks, you can check it out at mercatus.org. And the main point here is to make some suggestions about how states can reduce the effects of certificate of need laws, even if lawmakers are not willing to get rid of them entirely. So give us a couple of the ideas that you've included here.
So, of course, the first best option if you want to increase access to care, lower costs, and increased quality is to just eliminate certificate of need law. If, however, your legislators do not have the political will to do that because it will take away a lucrative benefit from a concentrated and highly organized interest group, what we offer is a number of alternatives or ways to get there. One is to just target particular types of procedures to not include, not require a certificate of need for. I would highlight in particular, start with procedures that limit access to care that's particularly needed by vulnerable populations. So certificates of need for a neonatal intensive care unit, for drug rehabilitation centers, for dialysis clinics, they really don't make a lot of sense. Another possibility is to set a glide path where you require the regulator to approve a certain percentage of CON applications this year and then increase that percentage next year and again the year after that until finally they have to approve 100% of all applications and you phase out the program. Another option is to reduce the power of the incumbent interest groups. So one possibility there would be to say, evaluate the criteria. So one of the criteria that's often used is they will look at whether this will duplicate the services of an existing provider. Well, what the regulators call duplication, economists and consumers call competition. And so this type of criteria essentially guarantees a local monopoly. Just eliminating that in and of itself would go a long way towards making healthcare more competitive.
Several good ideas there and more of them that you can check out again at mercatus.org. That's where you'll find the new report, Phasing Out Certificate of Need Laws. Matthew Mitchell, senior research fellow at Mercatus, and his colleagues have published that this week. You can find it there. Matt, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and thank you for your work on this issue, too.
And indeed, you can check out my work on certificate of need laws at reason.com. Specifically, go back and look at a story from a few years ago about a really just tragic incident involving an infant who died in Southwest Virginia, in part because of the awful legacy of these certificate of need laws in that state. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Bernie Sanders is a proud socialist. But in the presidential race, Pete Buttigieg has tried to cast himself as a moderate. But Buttigieg has been heavily influenced by socialist ideology as well. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
So, Mayor Pete is a red diaper baby. Well, that explains a lot. So writes Charlie, a longtime reader of my articles and books. Note that Charlie didn't call Pete Buttigieg a red, but a red diaper baby. There's a difference. And either way, it's a point that isn't irrelevant. As for that red diaper background, Charlie is referring to the work of Pete Buttigieg's father, Joseph Buttigieg, who was the English-speaking world's foremost expert on infamous Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci. Joseph, who died last year, was no less than founder of the International Gramsci Society, a fact acknowledged warmly at the Society's website. It's so unmissable that the first thing that displays when you open the website is Joseph's photo with a memorial tribute. As someone who regularly checks that website, I can tell you that Joseph's photo has been the lead for a full year and counting. And who was Antonio Gramsci? At the age of 35 in 1926, he was arrested in his native Italy by Mussolini and spent the last years of his life in prison, where he would write, compiling a master volume of 33 prison notebooks. Two of those notebooks, numbers 16 and 26, dealt explicitly with culture, that is, Gramsci's Marxist thoughts applied to culture. That's where Gramsci looked, particularly via his theory of cultural hegemony. If radical leftists truly wanted to win, they needed to seize the so-called cultural means of production, that is, culture-forming institutions such as the media and universities. Gramsci foresaw societal transformation coming about by what has been characterized as a long march through the institutions. Not until leftists came to dominate these cultural institutions would they be able to convince enough people to support their Marxist revolution. And that brings us to Pete Buttigieg's father, Joseph. The definitive English translation of Gramsci's work is Joseph Buttigieg's translation of the prison notebooks, published by Columbia University Press. Joseph produced three thick volumes, each around 700 pages, and in each of the volumes he begins with acknowledgments, concluding with special thanks to his son Pete, who helped index the volumes. Now, this short commentary here doesn't afford the time to lay out Joseph's or Pete's background at length. I encourage listeners to Google my piece of the American Spectator titled Mayor Pete, Red Diaper Baby. It's 4,000 words long. But this much I'll say here. Remember that Joseph Buttigieg's primary interest as a Marxist, like Antonio Gramsci's, was cultural. And his son, Pete, is very much a cultural leftist. If Mayor Pete is the so-called moderate in the Democratic bunch for 2020, it would be, at best, on perhaps certain matters of national security, foreign policy, economics, but most certainly not on cultural social issues. He's an extremist on abortion, obviously on the full swath of so-called LGBTQ issues, and he's radical in his interpretation of the Bible and religion. And yet, having said that, this is not to say that Mayor Pete is a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, but it is to say that he was surely exposed to far-left ideas through his father. Who wouldn't be? People, after all, are products of their environments and upbringings. A fair question for someone to ask Pete Buttigieg would be where and how his father's Marxism influenced his own political ideological views and where it didn't. My guess, however, is that those questions will not be asked of Mayor Pete. They won't be asked by a sympathetic liberal media that will want to protect him. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. For more, see my article, Mayor Pete, Red Diaper Baby, at the website of the American Spectator.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJNI-FM in Charleston, South Carolina, WKGM-AM in Smithfield, Virginia, and WHOF-FM in North Canton, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.